Quer saber de que forma a ciência e a tecnologia estão a alterar, melhorar ou até piorar as nossas vidas? Está no sítio certo. Hoje vamos falar de criptografia e a forma como ela está relacionada com aquilo que é o nosso mundo atual, da computação à computação quântica. E para isso temos connosco Sofia Celi, uma criptoriana que vive em Portugal. Bem-vindos ao podcast do Dinheiro Vivo, Made in Tech.
Can you believe it? Can you realize that we, that all of us, have actually begun the exploration of another world?
Olá, eu sou João Tomé e neste 63º episódio de 23 de junho de 2022 vamos falar de criptografia. É um tema que não é recente, já tem muitos anos, esse estudo da criptografia, mas que ganhou uma nova dimensão na área da computação nos últimos anos e na área da computação quântica, em particular também mais recentemente. As promessas que a criptografia promete são, de facto, imensas. Ela está relacionada não só com a privacidade, com a criptografia ou os dados encriptados para que ninguém possa aceder a eles. Isso tem estado muito em voga agora quando falamos de ferramentas como o WhatsApp, que teoricamente tem as suas mensagens encriptadas, ou outras. Portanto, há todo este lado de tornar as coisas verdadeiramente privadas, mas depois há todo um outro mundo que a criptografia permite, e é precisamente isso que vamos explorar com Sofia Celi. A Sofia vive em Lisboa, em Portugal, já há algum tempo, não muito, portanto há cerca de 3 anos, se não estou em erro, e portanto ela acaba por fazer um percurso muito interessante a partir do Equador. Ela é nascida e criada no Equador, até este mundo mais tecnológico da criptografia, e portanto há aqui vários elementos interessantes de conversa, não só por ser uma mulher que está a triunfar na tecnologia, sendo que ainda não há uma grande equidade nas áreas mais técnicas ou tecnológicas, mas isso está a ser alterado e, portanto, ela também é um nome interessante nessa área, mas também em todo o potencial que está relacionado com a criptografia. E nesta conversa com ela, vamos desde o trabalho dela em empresas como a Cloudflare ou, agora mais recentemente, a Brave, que é um browser, mas também vamos explorar temas um pouco mais amplos que podem ir inclusive à criação do universo, vivemos ou não numa simulação, coisas um pouco mais esotéricas, um pouco mais, eu diria, até rebuscadas, mas também interessantes. E também a promessa da criptografia e dos computadores quânticos. Será que eles vão ter vontade própria, como se costuma dizer, e quebrar todos os sistemas que temos hoje em dia? Portanto, há uma questão aí interessante que a Sofia Celi, também como pessoa que gosta de pensar muito nestes temas, aborda connosco. E ela tem uma experiência bastante interessante que vai além da própria tecnologia, até do ponto de vista dos cursos que tirou, relacionados com música, por exemplo, ou até com literatura. Portanto, esses domínios da literatura, daquilo que a literatura nos traz, a antiguidade, o conhecimento antigo nos traz para aquilo que é a tecnologia atual, também é muito interessante, e nesta conversa ela acaba por abordar esse tema. Sem mais demora, segue então a conversa com a Sofia Celi. Hello, Sofia. Olá, Sofia. How are you?
Hello, Joel. Thank you very much for having me here. Very well, and you?
Also good. We always ask everyone who participates in our podcast the same question. Where does this podcast find you?
So this podcast finds me in Lisbon, Portugal, in my home. So it's very nice.
You're in Lisbon, you work from Lisbon, but you are not from Portugal, of course. Can you set us up in terms of your background? Where did it all start for you? Where did you grow up? A little bit of your background.
Yes, yes, it's true. I'm in Portugal, but I'm not Portuguese. I'm Ecuadorian. I'm born in a country named Ecuador that is part of South America. And I was born in a city that is called Quito, which is in the Andean range. So it's has a very high altitude. Mm-hmm. And I initially studied classical music and literature, mm-hmm. But eventually switched to either attending mathematics and physics lectures at universities, and also learning to code. And that's how I ended up doing computer science things, and then specifically doing research about cryptography. And now I work at a company that's called Brave, and in the past I also work at Cloudflare, and also ThoughtWorks and other companies.
Of course. In terms of your background, growing up, I'm interested to know, first, when do you start getting interested in classical music? That's interesting. And also, were you tech savvy? Did you like mathematics and tech already when you were growing up, when you were like a child?
Yeah, so in terms of classical music, it wasn't really my choice. It was my mom's choice that put my brother and myself to study classical music when we were really young, because usually you start classical music, you don't have to, but the majority of times people start when they are very young, when they are children. So I started that because of that.
At and what then, age? What age and what
instruments? Around 10 and 11. And I used to, well, at the beginning, you don't really study any specific instrument. At the beginning, you only study the theory and a little bit of the of how everything works in classical music. And eventually, after like 2-3 years, you choose an instrument. And in my case, I chose classical guitar. So that's the one. Yes. Yeah, you go, sorry.
And regarding tech, were you always interested in mathematics and technology, science?
Yeah, so that is something that also came a little bit from the classical music background, because post-contemporary classical music uses a lot of computers and a lot of generated music to do compositions, and I started really getting interested in that. And at the same time, in my high school, I used to have a computer science, I guess that's how you call it, a computer science lessons. And I really got excited about HTML and coding through the terminal and all of that. So that's where I started. I did have some interest in the past about maths and physics, but on computers themselves, I started, I guess, in high school and in some interesting composition courses at the conservatory.
Interesting. And regarding your the college, you went to college, it was not right away in data science and mathematics, right?
Yeah, it was not. So I studied in college. Well, in my university, I studied specifically literature, but literature is kind of a specialization of communications. Mm-hmm. So it's communication with a specialization in literature, but that's what I studied. But at the same time, because it's communications, they also taught us at the university level about different new techniques to communicate through the end users, and that's the creation sometimes of websites. So again, I had some introductory courses to how to create websites and how to set up websites and all of this. Yeah.
So it was then where you started to look at technology in the sense of, in this case, websites in a different way? When did
yes.
it start growing?
So that started growing specifically on the last 2 years of my university. First, I was very interested in logic from a philosophical perspective, but also from a pure logic perspective. So I started attending a lot of logic courses, and then, of course, that led more into mathematics itself. And from the other hand, I was very interested in constructing websites and creating things through the web. So that's why I applied initially to a program that is called Rails Girls Summer of Code, that's specifically targeted from the Ruby community, targeted to women who want to start learning how to code. And I won the scholarship there. So I started also coding with them on Ruby since the beginning. And then this company that is called ThoughtWorks also had like an initial program of hiring people who were at initial levels of computer science, of coding in general. And I also applied sort of to that program at ThoughtWorks.
And you were also working in terms of social media. You were also doing communication consultant gigs and all that, right?
So
yes. You were always active, even in that area, more webmaster and community and communication, right?
Yeah, so at that, I had some jobs around that. So I had a job at my university. My university was a Catholic university. Well, it is, I guess. But at the time, it was my university, no longer my university. But it had a lot of programs of trying to teach specific indigenous communities in Ecuador, to teach them certain capabilities and certain things. Because it's really difficult to access or to go in person to these communities all of the time, the idea was to set up websites and online courses for them to be able to follow along. And I was part of the team that was actually constructing this platform for the online courses. And I also worked with Deutsche Welle and with the GateZ, which is the German corporation, international corporation. And that there I work also trying to teach journalism to these communities that needed to, that had like community journalism, and just to properly teach them certain journalistic techniques, and also supporting them in creating platforms to enhance their voices and what they needed as community, and also the work that they were doing with climate change.
Interesting. And cryptography, when did you start really to get an interest to think, hey, maybe this is the area to be at?
Yes, so that came also because a lot of these communities are sometimes persecuted by governments, and they don't have access. Of course, they don't have access to mass media, but rather they have to create their own journals. They have to create their own newspapers to even disseminate the kind of information they want to disseminate. Or sometimes they have to, because the mass media that in this specific country is only written in Spanish and it's not written in the original language that people speak. They also had a problem to even communicating what they had because it was not communicated in the mother tongue. So that's why we created on websites to try to find a way so they can communicate what the struggles they were having or what kind of success they were having through the internet. And that eventually led up to also that some of these people were actively persecuted through certain different entities. So that's where I started like more of the thinking about how to provide them with good security and good privacy of the communication itself. And then that led up into more the mathematical foundations that I loved because of my logic background and that I love logic. So that's why I started digging more into cryptography. So it started because I saw how, because of the internet, it's a great tool to actually disseminate information, but at the same time, it has risks from a security or privacy perspective, and trying to protect the people who try to use the internet to communicate, but sometimes they're threatened on that communication. But that's how it started.
Of course. Interesting. It's pretty much interesting. And regarding the next step after that, to be an expert, a real expert at that.
Yes. So I was hired by the company ThoughtWorks, and ThoughtWorks, there were also many departments. But one of them at the time is that they also had kind of a research group. It wasn't really called a research group. It was more like a security and privacy group. And that group was specifically targeting like the creation of protocols to protect the people's communications through the internet. And that's where I started. And I started with a protocol that is called off-the-record messaging communication, OTR, which is a protocol that tries to bring end-to-end encryption through the usage of cryptography, tries to bring end-to-end encryption to communications. So that's basically how it started. And from that, I just myself started learning from different books about the deep mathematical background of cryptography and tried to create all of these protocols. Yeah.
Interesting. And in terms of your cryptography, for those who don't understand what it is in a sense, how do you describe for like a five-year-old in a sense the dummy's explanation about cryptography and its importance in our society nowadays?
Yes, so cryptography is basically a science. It's a science that what it tries to do is to use certain mathematical foundations to preserve the security and privacy of the communications over any digital means. And the reason why it's so highly related with mathematics is because we have found certain mathematical problems that are really difficult to solve, even for really advanced computers. So for example, one of the foundations of the algorithms that we use nowadays to provide security and privacy is the exponentiation problem. So the idea that if you take a number and you exponentiate it to another number is really easy. But if you ask someone, you give them this result, the result of the number, and you ask them, what's the result of which two numbers generated this number, that is much more complicated to solve. And with really gigantic prime numbers, it's really complicated to solve this problem. So we use that as a base of the majority of cryptographic algorithms that we have. So the idea is that for you, it's too easy to encrypt something because it's really easy to generate these numbers, but it's really difficult for anyone else to decrypt it because they don't know these numbers that were used to generate the result. So that's basically cryptography, using these difficult mathematical problems in order to provide security and privacy.
In terms of use cases, and you already have a big experience in this area for the last few years, even at Cloudflare. In terms of your experience, which one was the use cases you saw more impactful, not only from your experience, but even in the world, how cryptography is changing things in specific use cases?
Yeah, so this is a really very interesting history of cryptography. So from the beginning, when the internet was created, when these digital communications came into being, there was not much concern of everybody, of anyone actually reading the communications, because the majority of people who were using the internet were just a really small set of people working in universities. But as the internet grew bigger and bigger, then it was obvious that some people will have the interest of looking at the communication of people, either to extract bank details or credit cards information, or to extract passwords, or to extract even the contents of the conversations themselves. And that's why it started to get into the thought of everybody that we needed something to protect them. And this is, for example, why the TLS protocol, or how it was called back then, the SSL protocol, was created to try to actually secure the communication between the servers and the client, so no attacker, no one looking in the middle of the network could actually extract whatever details you were sending through whatever website. There's another protocol at the same time that was proposed, that was the PGP protocol for the email communication, so no one could actually see the contents of the email, and you were assured not only that no one will not be able to read the contents of the email, but also that you knew that whomever was trying to talk to you was the correct person. So no one will be impersonating the participant of the conversation. So those were the two big properties that they were trying to protect. First, to protect the contents of the conversation, and also to provide a high assurance that you were talking with the correct entity. It could be this, it could be a server, or it could be a participant that you're sending someone. It could be anyone.
Of course, it's on the base of the internet. So yes. The internet works because people have trust that their communication goes from this place to the other. The email, of course, is a good example of that. And that protection, encryption gives that protection. There's a lot of different types of encryption, of course. But please continue.
Yes. So those were the two big ones. And eventually there were other protocols that were proposed, as the one that I just spoke about. The OTR protocol, for example, was proposed because a lot of people were using chat-based applications, and they were using it to just send as many casual messages as they wanted, but they didn't realize that sending of messages sometimes create an actual proof that you indeed said something. There comes along the OTR protocol to provide this property that's called deniability. And eventually, more of the properties were taken into consideration. So for example, recently there has been a lot of thought about what if, for example, you want to access a database, you want to access a specific index in a database. But when you send this specific index to the server that has this database, you are revealing to the server whatever it is that you're trying to look for. So that could be also a privacy implication. So cryptography can also help on that by trying to blind whatever element is that you're trying to access through the website. And think about this is, for example, even if, let's say that you're a browser, and in the browser you take a lot of measurements of your users because that's what you usually do on systems. But taking these measurements from users also is a big privacy implication because you are learning information from them. And sometimes it has happened that certain companies have sold that information to advertisement or marketing companies. So one of the ideas is also to use cryptography to take these measurements, but have them in a blinded manner, such as you cannot link them to a user, to a specific user that is using your system, but you still get those measurements that are needed to improve the system that you're providing. So all of those are like new questions on cryptography that now come more rather than more of like trying to secure the communication and try to obfuscate the contents of communication, it comes more from the consideration of privacy, protecting the rights of people to have privacy, to have anonymity, to have a way to deny having said something.
Yeah, it's a big area, of course. In terms of your experience so far, what was the thing that surprised you the most regarding cryptography that you think most people aren't aware of its importance?
Yeah, one of the things is that I always call cryptography a science of probabilities, because sometimes people think of cryptography as a perfect science in the sense that an algorithm is not possible to get broken. While that's not true, even the most secure algorithms that we have nowadays, as the one that I explained, the factorization problem, is not that not anybody will ever be able to guess if a number is the result of the multiplication or the exponentiation of two numbers. It is just that it will take a really long time and a lot of computational powers to be able to come with the answer. But it doesn't mean that it's impossible. It just means that someone, an adversary, will not probably want to solve that problem because it will take them a lot of resources, a lot of money, a lot of time to actually get the result. But one of the reasons why now we talk a lot about quantum computers is because cryptography is based as a science of probability on thinking that this problem is hard to solve because it will take a lot of time and resources. Quantum computers kind of diminish that, because with the new computational theory that goes beyond quantum computers, it means that they will be able to solve these problems much more easily, much more efficiently, much more faster. So that again shows that it's not a perfect science. It just means that with a high probability it will be impossible to break, because no one has that time or resources. But if someone has a quantum computer, they will be able to break it.
Regarding quantum computing, exactly. There, I think it's a matter, the possibility of quantum computers be able to break encryption. It's a matter of discussion for the last few years. And I found it very interesting. But I think, from my perspective, there's not a lot of assurances. Most people aren't sure as how that could work, because quantum computing is still not closed, is still evolving, right? Google had and also Microsoft and other players had announcements, big announcements in the last few years about quantum computing, but even those announcements doesn't give us the perfect quantum computer to use in most cases, right?
Yes. So right now we don't know exactly when a really powerful quantum computer will come. There are some already that exist that had indeed, for example, recently there was an experiment that a quantum computer was able to factor the number 15 and was able to come with the correct answer. That for us, very trivial, right? If I tell you what two numbers multiplied to be 15 is 5 and 3. Like, but for a quantum computer, this computer was actually now able to arrive to the correct answer, which is a huge improvement in the quantum computer area. But the problem why quantum computers are so difficult right now to be used in practice is because the world in which we live in follows also the principles of quantum mechanics, which means that we will have to isolate whatever process we're trying to have in a quantum computer. We have to isolate it in such a way that the world or the noise inside it also doesn't interfere into the answer that the quantum computer is trying to find, into the correct answer. So that is why it is so difficult. And then it's really difficult to also even properly define when does a quantum computer actually becomes powerful enough. Some researchers have proposed this term that is called quantum supremacy, which basically means that it kind of means that once a quantum computer has been shown that can much more efficiently solve an algorithm in comparison with a classical computer. But it's really difficult to actually determine that, because what if there comes a classical algorithm that it turns out to be faster? Or what if we create processors that are faster in the classical world, or we add more memory? How will we actually compare quantum computer with the classical computer is really difficult to precisely tell. And that's why for some researchers, some computers have reached quantum supremacy, and for others they say no, because the definition of self of reaching quantum supremacy is kind of not completely precise.
Exactly. The precision there is quite important. Yeah. So these are completely different computers, very powerful computers, the quantum computers, but the precision of their results is still remains to be checked, and yes. And that is a problem, right? Do you think the researchers and the industry there could have could change something in the next few years?
Yes, so I do think so. We have seen a lot of progress, and some of the quantum computer researchers have said that maybe in the next 30 or 50 years, there will be an actual realization of a quantum computer. But something that is important to think about when we think about quantum computers is that I don't think it will take a really, really long time for quantum computers to be the same as how we use classical computers, meaning that I don't think there will be a mobile quantum computer that we just put in our pockets and we walk around, because quantum computers are on the stage that classical computers were a long time ago, when they were like more like these Turing machines, when there were these gigantic computers with a lot of tubes, and then along came all of the modern hardware, and that meant that we could have laptops and mobile devices. That change between also these gigantic quantum computers to become like a laptop or mobile quantum computer, it will take a really long time. So what will happen is that a quantum computer will arrive, but only certain research centers will be able to have these gigantic quantum computers.
Exactly. In terms of use cases of quantum computers, do you have a sense of which use cases they could be more helpful? I've read about, for example, materials, finding new materials to use for different purposes, be that space or something about carbon emissions. Do you think there's use cases more easy to for a quantum computer to be used?
Yeah. So this goes into why I like quantum computers. So as a person that does cryptography, sometimes quantum computers are scary because, of course, they break a lot of parts of cryptography. But at the same time, they are an advancement to science. So one of the things that quantum computers can actually do is that it can allow us to understand how the real world works to a much more detailed level. So what happens nowadays is that quantum physicists has a lot of theories and a lot of proposed theories of how the universe works. And they have proofs and mathematical proofs that show indeed maybe this is the way the universe works, but there's not an experiment that actually shows that, because most of the classical computers that we have nowadays don't have enough memory or the enough computational power to be able to execute that experiment as nature around us does. So with a quantum computer, it would mean that we could do experiments and actually mimic how nature works in a much more efficient way. So that's a huge win for quantum theorists. And then another win is that because of this, it also means that we can mimic how molecules and how different parts of nature works. So that in turn means that we can test more properly different kinds of medicines. So we can test properly different kinds of materials that we can use. So that goes more into the win for the chemistry part. Mm-hmm. And of course,
medicine, yes. Vaccines, things, yes, like that could be use cases for the quantum computer.
Yeah. And the last thing is also certain other computer science problems also become more efficient. So any of the searching problems is much more easier to search, which is great for certain companies that are based on the searching problems. It becomes much more efficient, all of that. So that is also great from quantum computers.
Absolutely. It seems, in terms of future, it seems like a big promise. Of course, you are related to the Internet Research Task Force also, so you know a lot about the industry and the research area also. Where do you think the timeline is for quantum computing to be more seen in everyday life and society in general?
Yeah, so just recently, and I think mostly because of post-quantum cryptography, there has been now pushed more into the media talks about quantum computer, which didn't happen like 10 years ago. But nowadays it's happening. Even at the IATL level, at the Internet Research Task Force level, now there's even a group dedicated to standardize certain parts of the quantum research, which is called the QIRTG, I think, which is actually trying. So that is great because that means that certain things are actually put in motion even at the standardization level. Will I think that right now, like the general public will know that about quantum computers or care about that? I don't think so, but maybe in like 30 years, we will hear more about that. There's more proponents to even do other kinds of quantum computation, to even do cryptography with quantum properties, or to even do network propagations of different bytes and packages using quantum properties. There's also some ideas of that, but that seems all or more abstract. So I will just give it a little bit more of 30 years in order to that to properly land.
So what you are saying, it seems like not Web3, but like Web4 or Web5.
Yes.
Or something like that. Exactly.
Yeah.
So a quantum internet could be there. If not a completely new internet, at least new protocols that quantum computers can help in terms of cryptography also could be in place, right?
Yes, but I will give it that much more thought because it needs much more careful consideration.
Of course, yeah. And we don't know because science is always evolving. Sometimes it takes a long time, sometimes it's very quick. So it's difficult to predict. Nuclear fusion sciences have been saying like for the last 50 years that it's in 20 or 30 years time. And science right now say the same, or we're 20 or 30 years into that. So sometimes it takes a little bit longer than scientists would prefer, but things research has to be there, and sometimes things fall into place and sometimes they do not, right?
Yeah.
In terms of cryptography, how does cryptography help precisely the quantum computing area? How cryptographers are helping in this area? Because quantum computing is many disciplines type of computing, right? And cryptography is one of them. Can you set us up a little bit on that area?
Yeah, so in this area, quantum computers do break the majority of modern cryptography that we use nowadays. So anything that is based on the discrete logarithm, which is the base of a protocol that's called the Diffie-Hellman protocol, or anything that is based on the factorization problem, which is RSA, is broken by a quantum computer, specifically by an algorithm that is called Shor's algorithm. So TLS connections will be broken by a quantum computer, MLS connections will be broken, quick connections will be broken, all the majority of protocols that we use nowadays will be broken. Because quantum computers are so powerful, what this means is that if we go again with the example of the, if I give you 15, figure out which numbers arrive to 15, which is 5 and 3, we use these problems, not with 15, but really with gigantic numbers. We use these problems as a foundation of the mathematics behind cryptography. But for a quantum computer, this is easy to solve. It doesn't take a lot of time because they can collapse all of the possibilities into the correct answers. But for quantum computers, solving all of these mathematical problems that underlie modern cryptography is very, very easy, which in turn means that the majority of protocols and connections we use nowadays are threatened by a quantum computer. And what is even more threatening is that it's not only when the quantum computer actually arrives and becomes a realization, but rather even today, because an adversary can be right now be recording all of the TLS connections for whatever reason, they would be recording all of the TLS traffic. And once a quantum computer comes and arrives, they will be able to decrypt not only what comes in the future, but also all of that recorded traffic, all of those TLS traffic that somehow an adversary put in a database somewhere on storage, wherever, they will be able to even decrypt that past traffic. So that's the problem.
That's interesting. Let me ask you a question there. Does that mean that a quantum computer can, in theory at least, in the future, see past communications, even if they were encrypted in a sense.
Yes.
So has the full picture of the what happens on the internet, no data privacy at all there, because a quantum computer can take that all into and eliminate the protocols that exist in the internet right now, right?
Yes, that would happen with a quantum computer. If someone, for whatever reason, decides to record all of the traffic we have right now, which could be a real possibility, that some research facilities or some entities are actually recording all the traffic, and a quantum computer comes, it will be able to decrypt all of the past traffic that was recorded for whatever reason. Yeah.
But what type of quantum computer could do that? Could a quantum computer right now, the ones that we have right now, do that? And what danger is in place with that?
Yes. So right now, no. Right now, the quantum computers that we know that exist are only able to factorize the number 15. And we don't use the number 15 to protect our communication. We use really long prime numbers. So right now, they are not able to crack those prime numbers into whatever, how the prime number was actually generated. So maybe in 50 years, they will be able to do that and actually crack the prime numbers that are used for securing our connections nowadays.
So in terms of evolution, they're going on a track, on a path that can put them in cracking those protocols and those encryptions to the actual nowadays internet, in a sense.
Yes.
So the worry in terms of those who work at this area is to how to deal with that in the future.
Exactly. So now we are really worried because the majority of mathematical foundations of the protocols are going to be broken with quantum computers. Not all of them, like certain things from cryptography are not broken by quantum computers. So hashes are not broken, the MACs are not broken, certain types of encryption algorithms are not broken, but the majority are, or a big percentage is. So because of this, the National Institute of Technology of the United States started some years ago a competition that is called the post-quantum competition that asks which kind of algorithms can we develop now that are safe in the world that we live today and will also be safe against quantum computers. And that is what is called post-quantum cryptography, because it's beyond quantum computers. It's called post-quantum cryptography. And what it uses is that it uses other mathematical foundations such as lattices or isogenies or codes to create algorithms that are safe in the face of a quantum computer. That's coming.
Absolutely. So it's coming, and it's better to be prepared. In a sense, I find this area very interesting because, in a sense, it's a future. It's not already here, but it's not that far. I've read a very interesting book from Max Tegmark. He's like a futurist and physicist, which I love. And actually, I spoke with him a while back. His book is called like Life 3.0. And there he does a lot of futurism. But one of the areas of futurism is a super quantum computer that would do that, what you are saying in terms of possibility for the future. So it would encrypt everything. It would be very clever. It would trick humans into things. So in a sense, it was run by a group of humans, but not completely run, because it would do things for itself. But he has a few perspectives, a bad perspective in the book and a very good perspective of AI and quantum computing for the better. And the positive perspective, which I find very interesting, is the quantum computer is getting people to do better things, politicians to have better decisions in their everyday type of decisions, which I found a little bit hopeful. But it's like there's, in a sense, that computer and those who run it are they're not elected, of course, and they are in full power, a power never seen in the world. So that brings also some concerns. And nowadays, we have been talking, for example, on China and US tech rivalry, technology war, commerce war, and all that. And of course, that gives us a perspective of those who control technology, and for example, quantum computing, can be further down the line in terms of winning this type of war, not only a tech war, but also a commercial type of war. What do you think of this trend going on? Nobody, is there any country more advanced than others in this area?
Yeah, so that is very interesting and something that I've been also thinking. So the realization of quantum computers also bring with some inequalities in the sense that only big research facilities will be able to have these quantum computers. And these will be the ones that will be used to create better medicine or better batteries or better materials that will be found. So that means that, again, there's this inequality between that only these places are the ones who will be access to that research and therefore access to whatever products or whatever services came out of it, while others places will not be able to, which is what happened also with the beginning of computers, in which only also certain specific research institutes had access to these big computers. So that creates inequality because other parts of the world will probably not have access to these quantum computers. And the long road until we have a mobile quantum computer will take lots of years. So that would
some decades, right? Some decades, probably.
Yeah.
In that perspective, it's interesting to understand, and it goes back to history, like you were saying, the microchip, the computing type of history. Those, and the United States clearly was one of the countries that were more advanced in the computing part, even with the companies that were born there. They got a lot of patents. They got a lot of trends. The internet was created in a sense there, but it was expanded with the World Wide Web in the 90s in CERN. So Europe is also in play here. But in a sense, do you think that the power of computing, of course, helped to get more innovation in those countries? Mm. But do you think quantum computing could be even... in terms of accelerating the possibilities of innovation even higher and more difficult for a country to steal other countries' technology?
Yeah, so I just see two things. So the first one is that the quantum computers could create technology in the area of health that could really advance the knowledge that we have for how to properly do targeted medicines for specific cases. So that could be a huge technology supremacy for certain countries, and other countries might not have access to those, and probably they're going to be patented anything beyond that, everything that comes from it. So that could create a big inequality. And the second is that if certain entities also has access to these quantum computers and are able to decrypt traffic, they will not be only able to decrypt traffic of that specific region, but also whatever other region. So where there'll be legislations against like quantum computers being able to only decrypt traffic of specific regions that they have the legislation to, or will it be a free for all that they just can like decrypt any traffic of different countries? That can create a lot of geopolitical problems in the future.
Of course, yeah. Right now we're speaking of geopolitical problems regarding data that comes from the internet, of course. There's a lot of situations there, new regulation in Europe and other countries. 5G, where some countries don't want equipment from China and all that. So it's interesting to see that this could be in the future a new problem. Maybe a more closed one, because it all depends on who will get the best technology in terms of quantum computing. And would it make sense to announce to the world that, hey, we have this technology?
Yeah, that is also something that some people have been talking about, that maybe we will not really know some research institutes, because they are open and because they do all of research in the open, will announce that indeed they have a powerful quantum computer. But other entities might not be wanting that, so they might have one already and we don't know about.
That's an interesting perspective. So we can be, this reminds me of another discussion sometimes I have here in the podcast, mainly with astrophysics and or physics. So it's a bit a bigger play in terms of a thing. But quantum computing reminds me a little bit of that, because in a sense, it's the ultimate question. Do we live in a simulation? And yeah. The second, the follow-up question, do we care that we live in a simulation? Because we don't have any power on that, if we do or not.
Yeah.
So do you have any views on that? I know this is a more philosophical question, but you study literature and philosophy. Maybe you have a good perspective there on the universe or on the possibilities of simulation.
Yeah, so this is a really fun thing. So I go more into the perspective of different worlds existing at the same time, a different reality, the multiverse, what they call it. Nowadays, it's really, a lot of people are talking about the multiverse, I think, because Marvel did a movie about the multiverse or something.
They did, yeah.
Yeah. So I go more into the perspective of the multiverse, and I really like the idea. There's even a really big Latin American writer by the name of Jorge Luis Borges, which also talks about all of the possibilities and all of the probabilities and how certain things collapse into one. And but in other possibilities, something else might be happening. I really love that. What I have been thinking about quantum computers is that if they ever became so powerful that we can create with them a simulation itself, like we can create a simulation of the world in itself. And will that be a world or not, or as ours?
Exactly.
That could also be a thing.
there's, in a sense, there's already discussions about that, on what is reality. What happens on the internet is reality or not? In a sense, it seems like it. Does our memory can be downloaded in the future to be on the internet always? That's another question.
And that's a question that came even from the ancient Greeks, right? Like the foundation of philosophy in Western philosophy. There's this very interesting philosopher that I forget the name, who asked, like, how do you know if you see the same color as myself? Like, meaning, how do you know that what you see as blue is what I see as blue? And that's the limit of the senses that we have, in the sense that we cannot really even know that we're looking into the correct color. We are looking at the same thing, because of the interpretation that we have through our senses, how things are limited through the senses. And this now goes to Wittgenstein and all of the philosophers later that say that the world is just the limitation of our senses.
Absolutely. Actually, I heard a very interesting podcast with Sam Harris, the philosopher, American philosopher, and it was like about the self. And he explains exactly that, what you were saying. The way we see the world, sometimes it's reality for us, but sometimes it's not the complete reality, because an animal with infrared type of vision sees the world completely different. A cat sees the world completely different that we see. So although the objects are there, we feel them in a sense, but the way they are really could be different from the perspective of those who see them.
Yeah. And this later on philosophy was like the big question of what is actually the truth, and like if we could ever grasp the truth itself. There's even one, I think it's Spinoza. Yeah. Spinoza is a Jew philosopher who talks about that we will never be able to grasp the truth, because the substance of the truth is different to our substance. So we will never be able to go beyond the threshold, which is really interesting. So that could be awesome.
It's interesting because there's a few things in the past few years that give truth a bad name. and in a sense, this philosophy type of thought makes sense, because what is the truth? We could get the best knowledge on a thing that we can have with today's science, today's information, and be truth-worthy in a sense, or at least honest about it and knowledgeable about it. But the truth is a very difficult concept. And it's interesting because there's a lot of, even in Portugal, and you probably know this, there's a lot of groups saying the truth about COVID, the truth about 5G, the truth about, and it's interesting there, the use of the word truth in a very peculiar manner, let's say like that. But going back to the Moldaverse, I want to dig in a little bit more on that, on your views. What do you think of in terms of possibilities of the universe being really a multiverse? How, in your cryptography mind, mathematical mind, how that could work?
Oh, I really love it. I love the idea of having different multiverses. And indeed, it's something that could happen even with quantum theory, meaning that all possibilities are there waiting to be happening or almost happening at the same time until something collapses them. So there's the famous Schrodinger's cat, in which the cat is alive and dead until someone opens the box and sees if it's alive or dead. And I love that because it means that all of the possibilities are there waiting to happen or happening at the same time. And
for really example, could you give like an example? There's a lot of movies about it. Of course, you talked about the Marvel one about metaverse, multiverses actually. And so in a room, we can have different, we are in one planet, we are in a specific place. There could be multi things happening. A multiverse is a multi-universe is happening in the same space, let's say like that, right?
Yes, I really love the one from popular culture that I really love how they do this is Rick and Morty. And there's a specific episode in which Morty asks for like a specific device in which he can like rewind time. Every time that he makes a mistake or something bad happens, he can rewind time and do it again. And he's like, oh, but I was just rewinding time because everything goes wrong. And eventually there's a problem. And he goes to Morty, and ask him, like, could you, you know, undo all of this? Because I was just rewinding time. And Rick explains, like, that's not possible. What was happening is that I was putting you in the possibility, in the probability where everything went as you wanted it to go, but it indeed happened that you committed that mistake or that other thing. It's just that I moved you to when you got it right.
Exactly. So it seems like there was a back in time, but not really. Yeah, you just tried it a lot. There's a bunch of movies I like that gives us this concept. One is Groundhog Day with Billy Murray. It's a comedy, but it repeats the same day over and over and over and over. Yes. But it has a philosophical type of thing there, which I found very interesting. Of course, the Chris Nolan movie, I forget the name.
There's the one about the dreams.
With Matthew McConaughey. I forgot. Chris Nolan.
Yeah, but Nolan is actually, for anybody that's listening, is basically uses a lot of references to this Latin American writer that I was talking about, to Borges. If everybody is interested in reading about possibilities of past, there's one tale by Borges that's called The Garden with All the Possible Paths or something like that. I don't remember the translation in English. But that's a 5-page story that's really good into this.
In terms of what's coming, do you think the future is right for this area, cryptography and quantum computing?
Yes, and I love that these things are coming more into a realization. For example, one of the things that happened when quantum theory was kind of discovered, quotes and quotes, was that Einstein hated quantum theory because it was like, why? Like, and things are really weird in quantum theory. While all of these things are actually considering different possibilities, so what is the right one, or what's the meaning of the truth, and what is like, is God related to the truth or not? And all of these questions were already posed by philosophy long time ago when eventually came into a realization on quantum theory. And later, now maybe we have a more realization if ever quantum computer come to a being.
Exactly. It's like discovering there's a new world we didn't know about. actually, all related to quantum physics and all that, all gives us a new world of possibilities. So it's confusing because we know now that we know less than we thought we knew.
Yes.
So we know now that we are more ignorant in a sense. Yes. By knowing more, we know that we are more ignorant than before.
Yeah. Which is interesting. This reminds me so much to the Greeks itself, because one of the maxims, one of the biggest sentences of Socrates was that the only thing that I know is that I don't know, which gives you all of this vast array of possibilities, because that means that you're open to learning something new. But I think one of the reasons why in society we try so much to try to find the correct route, be this God or be this, I don't know, whatever truth you read, is because we came from also this tradition of Plato, and Plato was always saying that there should be a truth from which all of the things derive, and there should be at least one. And we still kind of sometimes try to still use that kind of thinking that there should be one thing that is the truth, when sometimes maybe there's like many truths happening.
Absolutely.
At the same time.
Absolutely. A more personal question. I understand if you don't want to answer. It's not that personal. I see this a lot in science, and you do also a lot of science there, research and all that. In terms of believing there's a higher entity, like a god. It's not completely clear if you're in science, you can believe there's a higher entity or not. So it's not a full picture. They're, all the science people are agnostic or atheist, not necessarily. Do you have a sense of, from what you've researched already, where things will go?
Yeah, so there has sometimes been kind of thinking about actually trying to attest if God exists or not with actual physical evidence, which the religion or the majority of the religions will go against, because there's no, what religion, at least when I used to read about theology, what religion used to attest is that we should not ask for an actual proof, because it's a leap of faith, right? It's, the faith is the proof that actually a higher entity exists. But I do like thinking that there are certain things that get repeated among humans, and this goes more into, I guess, psychology, with the ideas laid by Carl Gustav Jung, which some of the ideas I like, some of those ideas that he posed I do not like, but his idea is basically there are these kind of base ideas in the mind of everybody, maybe in the subconscious mind of everybody, from which we try to base certain thinking. So for example, in the majority of cultures, there's always a first couple that try to populate the earth. In the majority of cultures, there's a god of the sun and things like that. And he calls these a repeated patterns that we have at the unconscious level. And maybe that's what indeed created the notion of God eventually. Of some things that maybe we share more on an unconscious level.
Of course, we need, as humans are very interesting there, I think, because humans need answers. And when they don't get it, they usually become more spiritual in a sense. They get their answers with spirituality or with a higher entity that explains everything they don't understand. And there's that very interesting perspective throughout human history, actually. We don't know that animals, at least so far, that animals have any type of belief in terms of religion or higher entity, because probably they don't need the answers that we need. But there's the other part there, which is, hey, this is a very complex and peculiar universe full of kind of planets and galaxies and expanding to we don't know where. And it all started with supposedly a Big Bang, although even that sometimes is difficult to grasp. Maybe there's something more than just this void of space.
Yeah, I generally don't think, I like thinking that we are indeed part of the void. That sounds really bad, but I really like that, or the universe itself. But I do see why some people like to think about the idea of God. And I think that is very interesting and very good, in the sense that for some people, the idea of God gives gives a direction, gives a way to live your life, which is completely good. When the politicization of religion happens later on in the history of humanity, I don't really like it that much, because eventually religion becomes this thing that we should kill other people because they don't follow our religion or something like that. I don't really like that politicization. But of course, the core idea of God is not per se bad, or the core idea of what, for example, even Jesus Christ tried to transmit it, which was, you know, love each other, it's not something bad. So that I definitely like, the ideas behind certain gods are definitely worth having in society.
Absolutely, absolutely. And gives people a purpose, actually, yeah. Which is interesting. Even in the philosophy type of thing, it's pretty much interesting, and give people a sense of community because they belong to something. It's even in the sociological type of thing, it's interesting to see how it plays out. Before you go, I want to go back a little bit in our conversation to being in Lisbon. When did you start? How that came up?
Yes, that came up because of Cloudflare. So I used to work at Cloudflare a month and 2 days ago, I guess. And I moved to Lisbon because of Cloudflare, because they have an office here. So I moved because of them. And then ever since I moved here, I decided also to stay because I really like living here in Portugal.
And so you're in Lisbon since when?
Since 2000. What year are we? 19, I think. The end of 2019.
I think. So you open almost the Lisbon office.
That yes, was, I think.
It opened in 2019.
No, I think it was 2020 that I moved. Oh. Sorry, it's just this COVID times have my time, like really.
Of course. we can say it like this. It's pre-COVID or after COVID?
No, after COVID. After COVID.
After, so it's 2020. That's 2020.
Yeah, but I was supposed to move earlier. I was supposed to move in 2019, but then COVID happened and I couldn't move. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in terms of your experience here, what do you think of Lisbon as a place to work, to do research? Of course, now we have technology tools, but what do you think of the city and the country?
Yes, I really love it. And it's a very calm place to live and also to do the research. There's some groups that do research specifically in cryptography, that do research around formal verification, for example. A really great professor by the name of Manuel Barbosa, he does a lot of research here and leads the research here, which is definitely good. Even there has been recently a symposium about quantum computers or something like that also in Lisbon. That was really definitely interesting. So yeah, it's really beautiful. The weather and the temperature is also super nice all year around, I would say. Doesn't really get that cold. So I really like it, and it's very calm and very peaceful. So definitely a place to do research.
And your years at Cloudflare, your time at Cloudflare, yeah. did you enjoy it? And
yes, definitely enjoyed it. I didn't have, so I don't know right now, but at the time that I joined, there was no one else in Lisbon working at my team, other teams they had with me. But I think now they're trying to expand that, because sometimes it's nice to have actually people in person working with you. But the office is really lovely. It's very nearby my place, so I really loved it. And I also love to see some of my colleagues there. So going to the office and see JCC and see other people was always really fun.
But in terms of your work, what did you achieve there and learn?
Oh yes. So at Cloudflare, I achieved many things actually. So I started digging more into TLS itself and how to use a mechanism that is called delegated credentials for it, and also how to transition TLS for a post-quantum world. I worked a lot on Privacy Pass, which is a protocol that tries to achieve privacy for when you're issued cookies, when you solve a different type of CAPTCHA. So instead of being handled a cookie, you handle an anonymous token for usage of that. I also work in another protocol that was called Opaque, which is a way to, in a better manner, store passwords rather than having them to be stored in plain text or encrypted in a service. rather to have a representation of the password. So if there's some server leakage, there's not much of a compromise for the user's password itself. And as well, I did a lot of post-quantum research at Cloudflare by implementing novel protocols that try to give us post-quantum cryptography. And also one of the things that we were doing at the time, I don't know if it continues, but I hope it continues, was that we were transitioning all of the internal collections of Cloudflare or certain products from Cloudflare to use post-quantum cryptography. So that was very fun, very nice.
And now Brave, what is the challenge there in terms of your work as a cryptographer?
Yeah, so it was the same. I have been following the same line of researching around post-quantum cryptography, but now I'm also digging more into privacy problems. So for example, these ideas of how to have private measurements and private measurements that you take from the users, looking at the PKI and trying to solve privacy problems in the PKI that TLS uses as well. Trying to figure out also more detailed and fine-grained properties of these anonymous tokens that we were just talking about. So the work continues on privacy and post-quantum also on this side. And of course, when I'm at Cloudflare, I learned about a lot of things from the server side. So, or from the middle side, I would say, it's not the origin server, but kind of like the second server, let's call it the second server, from the second server side. But now I'm actually learning more from the client, from the browser, which is something that I was really interested in knowing, like, how does the browser look from behind? Yeah,
exactly. So in terms of career, is also important, I understand, for you to have different experiences, in this case with the browser that people use directly. So that could also be at use in your experience, right?
Yes, I know that now sometimes there has been some thoughts about even doing the majority of computations now happen on the client side to also execute them on the cloud or execute them more on the server side. And there's debate between how many of those computations should be executed at the server and how many of them executed at the client. Some people just want to use everything on the client, some people want to use everything on the server. So yeah, there's a big debate.
Of course, yeah, it's interesting. In terms of your career, do you think you're now a world expert in this area? How do you feel in terms of this area and what you can contribute to the area, given that you're also in that task force?
Yeah, so I always feel like I don't know a lot, but maybe that's just my perception. But definitely have been learning much more around privacy, what kind of specific implications there are, because sometimes with privacy, it's also very detailed. Sometimes what kind of minor implications could there be, and one has to be really careful about them. About post-quantum cryptography, I do have some expertise about putting it into networks and the computational needs that they have, but I'm digging much more and more nowadays into the actual mathematics behind the algorithms. That is something that I still have to learn. So the road is still long, but hopefully every year I will be learning some new things.
Do you have like a big inspiration in this area that you think...
Yes.
helped you and it's doing amazing stuff in the world?
Yes. So one of my biggest patients is Stephen Galbraith, who is a professor and a researcher in New Zealand. And he has done so much to push the mathematics behind the cryptographic algorithms. And he's leading a lot of things around post-quantum also. And he's also a person that is deeply interested about improving diversity in our field. That I definitely admire. I admire a lot the CTO of Cloudflare, which is John Graham, and also because of the technology achievements that he has done, but also because he was one of the people who were advocating for the pattern of Turing. So I always like people who advance a lot of mathematics and technology, but also they take into account the social aspect of it. And of course, a person that I also admire quite deeply is Tanya Lange, because she's one of the few women cryptographers, really well-known cryptographers. There are now a lot of women cryptographers, but on her generation, I guess, she's one of the most well-known cryptographers in the area. She has also advanced so much the post-quantum thought. So I an elliptic curves also, she does a lot of elliptic curves, so I deeply admire her as well.
There's a lot of reference. And in terms of more in the past, historical figures in this area that that probably created this area that you want to highlight.
Yeah, so that for sure, Turing is really amazing to read any of his research. When he's talking about artificial intelligence, when he's talking about how to compute these Turing machines that eventually became what we use computers nowadays, I definitely admire Turing. So yeah, I think he will be one of the biggest ones, at least on the computer science era. And of course, there's Ada Lovelace, who also advanced a lot. And she's also one of the few women who were pushing for it. There's Heidi Lamarr. She was also a Hollywood actress, but also advanced all of these Bluetooth innovations. So definitely them.
Interesting. Just wrap things up. In terms of your career, where do you see it going? Where do you want still to go in terms of things you want to do in this area?
Yeah, so I want to learn more about the privacy implications of certain different things. And there's something specific about learning about Boolean secrets or arithmetic secrets, which recently I got obsessed with. It's not really interesting if you are not into cryptography, not really interesting at all. But I got really interested into them. And I would really like to learn more about quantum computing itself. I know some of the basics, but I would like to learn more the details, as well as quantum theory itself. So more of the physics part, I would also like to learn more.
For those who are starting in this area, be them boy or girl, what advices do you want to leave them in terms of pursuing a job or even knowledge in technology in general, but also in this more focused quantum computing cryptography area?
Yeah, so one thing is read as much as possible any paper. Sometimes what happens when you're studying cryptography or any of the other fields is that sometimes you get this paper and they seem really technical and really complex, but sometimes it's just a matter of learning the vocabulary. What, for example, if you read in mathematics and you read a degree and you don't know what a degree is, it's just a representation of something else that the mathematicians can have given it. For easiness of usage, but that's all. So all of these things, I said, just read it and keeping in mind and just learning more and more. And one thing that really helped me early in my career was also I sent emails to a lot of professors back then, and most of them answered back, not all of them, but most of them answered back and explained to me any of the terms that I was inquiring them about, or if I wanted to have a call, they jump with me in a call. So it's a really welcoming community in that. So don't feel afraid to actually reach out to me or to anybody else about trying to dig more into cryptography. Actually, one of the people who I also admire a lot is Thomas Ristenbarton, one of the people who once I messaged and he always replied and explained me a lot of things, and also Mike Hamburg, and I really like them because they were the first people to ever explain me certain things. So that's one thing. And the other thing is try to find certain allies in the community that will help you, for example, with scholarships or with troubleships. I don't know if that's the word, troubleships, but with actual economic support for you to travel. Because one of the problems with living sometimes in the global south is that it's really difficult to travel to all of these conferences that happen in the global north, because it's really expensive, because it really takes a lot of time. And if you don't have a support, it could be really difficult. So try to apply to some of the scholarship, or try to find allies in the community that are pushing for diversity and will help you. Because there's a lot of people who are trying to push for diversity, and it's good to do the connection and actually find. We need more diverse people in the community. So if you're interested, just apply, please.
Last two questions, and these ones are short. First, was there something in your past experience in literature or philosophy on your studies that helped you in your job as a cryptographer, in a sense? So I love this idea of being multidisciplined. All of your experience can contribute for the future. So if you were, I was a journalist for a number of years, and I do a different thing, but being a journalist for a number of years helped me a lot. So maybe your past experience could help you also in your new, your area now.
Yes, so definitely gives me a more broader perspective, I'll say. So for example, when I work with all of these indigenous communities in Ecuador, it did help me to see specifically what kind of threats they were facing from digital means. I also worked in a, I'm currently work with a lot of women who have been survivors of domestic violence through that has also used digital means. And hearing their experience helps me to do proper research to actually protect that kind of people. That if I didn't have that kind of contact, maybe I would not even know, I would be having ignorance about that. But actually talking with the people and going with them, I know exactly what I have to protect them from, or what kind of consideration I have to take into my mind. And one of the things also that is definitely helpful from studying different things is that it gives you the possibility to do inter-research. So for example, one of the things that I was recently getting interested in is to use quantum computers for music. So that is something that maybe I can explore because of the classical musical background. Then you can be a bridge between these two communities that otherwise maybe they will not talk to each other. So that's definitely something nice always to have.
Exactly. And last but not least, favorite word in Portuguese?
Oh, I love saudade. Which is, you know, they always say that they cannot translate this word. It's the longing for something that is very close to you.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. And but I do have found, because I study at ancient Greek, and in ancient Greek there's this word that still belongs, I guess, in Portuguese and also in Spanish, which is nostalgia. Nostalgia means, nostos means close, and algia means pain. And it's what Ulysses, Odysseus, feels when he's in this trip and he cannot get back home. He feels like this nostalgia because it's something that's close to his heart, but far away.
Yeah, it's also a good word, actually. It's also there in English, I think.
Because English preserves Greek as it is, ancient Greek as it is. Yeah,
exactly. That's a good one also. Thank you so much. Hope you liked it.
Yes. Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Thank you.
E pronto, por esta semana está feito. Este podcast foi criado por mim, João Tomé, e tem edição de som do Luís Stoffel. Se gostou do que ouviu, siga-nos nas principais plataformas de podcast. Se gostou mesmo, avalie-nos e passe a palavra. Até ao próximo episódio de Made in Tech.